This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Devilish Dogs and Lost Unicorns. Traumatic moments in children's animated feature films.
We're going to get real today.
Yeah, I know. I realise that is an oddly specific title, but it suddenly occurred to me just how many of these films there were.
Seriously, yeah. And weirdly enough, and because Jules was the one who recommended this episode, but it was something that was going on in the back of my mind. Because, and I won't say which one yet, because we will inevitably talk about this film. But on Netflix, they had this film up, and as the, you know, on Netflix they have a little picture from, like, yeah, a screenshot from the film. The screenshot that they had on Netflix was of the most traumatic scene. And I was like,
it's like, yeah, that's a real recommendation.
Like, Netflix, why would you remind us of the most traumatic moment of our childhood? Like, why would you do that, Netflix?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. There was a lot of these films, sort of, they came out when I was a child, and obviously you inherited them and the ones that followed on. And nobody thought about content warnings back then, if it was for children, or considered suitable for children by sort of Mary Whitehouse and her ilk, then, yeah, it just got stamped with a big U, or even a PG in some cases, and then it was just considered fine. Not thinking about how a child might take a theme or something and internalise it in a completely different way to an adult watching the same thing. That's not to say these films are bad. They're not. Children do actually have a need appropriate to the child and their age, which, you know, both things can vary, to see things which are complicated theme-wise and are occasionally, you know, that push the boundaries of things they're comfortable with. This is a safe environment for them to basically confront their nightmares, if you like. And if that's something you don't do as a child, then that's something that's far more difficult to do as an adult. It's the whole point of, you know, the latter version of fairy tales, obviously, before the Victorians sanitised it. So I'm not advocating for completely sanitising children's films. No. But on the other hand, I have to think back and think, how much of this shaped me in a very specific way?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's important that, as you say, people can go to the extreme in the other direction with this.
Yeah.
And the reason that that isn't a great idea is that actually children are able to deal with certain things better in some respects than adults. And certain themes do really matter in children's media, because it actually helps them cope with the real world. For instance, the theme of death appears a lot in children's stories. Particularly, you get to middle grade, and then you get to middle grade, and suddenly there's a lot of death in the stories. And it's the death of someone beloved. So parents being killed
absolutely.
Off, and orphans. And we've talked about that in the past, about why that's a practical decision on the writer's part as well. But also, I think it's very important, because children at that age, usually it's around that time that they start to experience death in the real world. So it might be a grandparent, it might be a beloved pet, okay? But it's around that time that they start to experience death in some way, or the reality of death, they become conscious of it. So by actually putting it into films and stuff like that, you're helping them to actually navigate the real world, because this is a theme that they're thinking of, that they're worried about, and it helps them to process it. So you can't remove those kinds of themes, actually. I think they're very, very important. That being said, sometimes things are introduced which really are a bit too much.
Yeah, or you sort of look at them and think, what were you thinking? What made you think that that was particularly something that a child should see?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, and it depends, because your empathy isn't fully developed as a child. And to be honest, your empathy isn't fully developed for a lot of adults.
Yeah.
That's something that comes with experience as well. Mm. But particularly for children, a lot of children have this healthy sort of callousness, and they should do, because they're gradually going from the stage of believing themselves to be the centre of the universe to realising that everyone else is just as real and just as important as they are. And that's part of developing as a person.
Yeah.
And all that's fine. So some of these things just aren't going to hit every child on the same level. But then you can have children who are really, really super sensitive to all of these things because they've developed all this early for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of those children. So it was almost like I then had to develop a layer of armour to go over that.
Yeah.
That understanding in order to process things which were deemed suitable for my age. So so it's a bit of a dichotomy, really. But anyway, we're particularly looking at animated films, although I expect we'll talk about one or two others.
Yeah.
I want to particularly mention Don Bluth.
Right.
Don Bluth manages to create some of the most disturbing moments in children's animated feature films. The animation is nearly always beautiful. The characters are multi-layered. There's plenty of depth. The plots are generally quite complicated, particularly for children, but, you know, people are still managing it. And they are quite immersive, but there's a definite taste of darkness with these films as well. So if you think, not the later Disney films, but the earlier, not the very early ones, the ones that sort of came along in the 80s and early 90s, whereby you knew going in that everything was going to turn out all right. Don Bluth films, you went in and you weren't really sure whether they were all going to turn out all right by the end, even if it was a children's film. Quite often they had bittersweet endings as well. So I'll talk about some of those. I'm not really going to talk about Disney too much today, apart from one particular scene in one film.
Okay.
Which I think was a bit of a turning point. Because, you know, I like Disney, but this isn't really producing traumatic stuff, and I don't care what people say about the death of Bambi's mother, etc., etc. It's just not in the same class as some of the stuff. I'm sorry, it really isn't.
Okay, go on.
Okay, well, I suppose the one that will hit me straight away is The Last Unicorn.
Yeah.
Which is obviously an animated film adapted in the 80s from Peter S. Beagle's classic award-winning book of the same name. I think they do quite a good job with the adaptation of the book. They've taken the themes, they've taken the characters, and they've made them very real. Some of the more convoluted bits they've got rid of because they didn't need it. And it's great. It's beautifully animated. Great music by America. And yeah, the bit that really traumatised me. Oh, God. I may have even told this story before. My mother was working night shifts at the hospital at the time. She had me and my sister. And she was obviously exhausted, and she thought she could grab a couple of hours sleep by going to the video shop. It was videos back then. And getting this for us, because I'd been desperate to see it. Sitting us down in front of the video, and she could grab a couple of hours sleep. That's not quite what happened, because spoilers for all of these films, by the way, guys. Halfway through The Last Unicorn, in order to survive the first attack by the Red Bull, The Last Unicorn is turned into a woman called Amalthea.
Yeah.
And that was sort of like, that was awful, because I'd really, really identified with this unicorn, you know. A female character off doing her thing and not a useless, boring human, but a unicorn. And the fact that she then got turned into basically a princess really upset me, to the point where I went and stood at the bottom of the stairs and bellowed for my mother, who had managed to just get to sleep. My name was Mud. It really, really was. But I think, looking back, and it's always tempting to put an adult filter on memories that come to you from being recorded when you were a child, so I'm trying not to do that, but what it was, that was the most tragic thing that could have happened. The Red Bull killing the unicorn wouldn't have been as bad. For me, her being forced into a shape that wasn't hers and the moment when she says, I can feel this body dying all around me, because she's not a mortal anymore. She's been forced to be this mortal human creature, yeah. A girl. And that struck something for me that perhaps, you know, even now I haven't really necessarily unraveled everything for, but it was awful. It was really, really upsetting. Anyway, I did get to the end of the film, and obviously she gets turned back into a unicorn, so all is well. But my God, at the time, I was, what, 7, I think?
You know, it's actually kind of interesting, because for me, it was sort of the opposite. I was incredibly sad to discover that she had, you know, she'd been turned into a human. She'd kind of found this love. And then there was that kind of that bittersweetness at the end where she's turned back and he can't be with her. And that made me incredibly sad. I was always like, aw.
Yeah, it's like she became the one unicorn who could actually feel regret.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is very bittersweet. At the time I first saw it, though, I was hating all of that. I was sat there thinking the child version of, stay away from her, Leah. She does not want to be with a bloke. And as I said, you know, without putting an adult slant on a child's memory, I can't really tell you why I felt that strongly about it, but I really, really yeah. did. I think it was only watching it the second and third and fourth time round, because we used to get mileage out of our videos, where I was sort of like, okay, I'm willing to allow this bit of the story to happen now because I know everything turns out all right. And I have to say, that's kind of an attitude that if a film really gets me, particularly if it's something that's so in my wheelhouse, like The Last Unicorn mm-hmm. was, that I will sit there stressed until everything works out right, and then I'm kind of like, I'm okay, and I'm ready to go back and watch it again and actually enjoy it. That's kind of how I felt about Star Wars. That's definitely how I felt about The Cursed Child. You know, I'm probably not a very fun person to go and see certain films and plays with, because I'm just this knot of tension sat next to you.
I know how you feel. Okay. All right. So, sorry, I'm just imagining you just like hands in knots, you know. Okay.
Oh man, yeah.
All right. So I'm going to go with one now. And it was actually the one I was mentioning that was on Netflix. And it's Neverending Story.
But yeah. Obviously not animated, but very much a children's film.
Yeah. And the Neverending Story scared the living bejesus out of me. It really, really did. I was so scared of it. I loved it, but I was terrified of it. There were two bits that really scared me. The wolf in the Neverending Story...
Yeah.
Elicited an absolute terror of wolves in me for a very long time. I was terrified of werewolves and stuff like that, because he was so frightening. He really, really was terrifying. And there were a lot of very weird, uncanny kind of creatures in the Neverending Story, which really got under my skin. But the most traumatic moment of any film up until that point that I'd ever watched is the bit where Atreyu is leading his horse through these marshes.
Yeah.
I think it's like the Marsh of Despair or something like that.
Yeah, it is. And you won't drown or sink unless it gets to you. And if it gets to you, then that's it. You stop fighting and you just die.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the horse just gives in. And Atreyu is desperately trying to pull his horse out and just getting more and more desperate. And in the end, he's screaming and shouting and fighting and pulling and crying. And I was just a mess.
I know. It's awful. It is still really traumatic now, isn't it? It's like, oh yeah, this is good, clean kids' fun. No, it's like, not. No, it's not. Artex is dying.
He is, and it's just Atreyu's reaction as well is, and again, I haven't watched this in a long time, so maybe I'd look back and go, wow, this is terrible child acting. But at the time, it was incredibly real to me. Incredibly real. That he is just right before his eyes with that growing terror and realization, he's losing the only person, the only thing he has in his life. And it was so traumatic, because up until that point, I'd watched stuff whereby, you know, a parent had died or something like that, but you never saw it happening in the same way. You never saw it happening like that. I mean, even with Bambi, you know, people say, oh, that's totally traumatic.
It's like, eh, it's off screen.
You don't see it, like, that's actually literally happening at that moment, and he's begging and crying and screaming, and he can't do anything, and he's totally powerless. And the really interesting thing about that is, I think also, it really, really got to me, because it wasn't just this idea of death, it was this idea that sometimes you can do your absolute best, and it won't be enough.
Yeah.
And this is not a situation whereby it would have been impossible. You know, he should have been able to pull that horse out, but he was just a kid and the horse had kind of given up.
And you couldn't reason with it. That's the other thing, because it was a horse.
Yeah. But it also, for me, it highlighted the fact that actually, you know, when things go bad, sometimes it's not enough and you can't reason with people. And it's just, it's over, you know? And that was absolutely terrifying. And I think also, unbeknownst to me at the time, and the reason why it really struck me and hurt me in a very particular way was that I was also kind of being introduced to the idea of depression in that moment.
Yeah.
And that if someone you love falls prey to that, you know, and they're, you can be standing right in front of them screaming at them and they just can't hear you. And
yeah, you can't reason with them. Just the same as you can't reason with a horse.
And it's just this giving up, and they can be fighting and fighting and fighting. And that was a terrifying notion. A terrifying notion that you can love someone so much and desperately be fighting for them, and it just won't be enough.
And yeah.
That was way too much for me when I was a child.
Yeah, and there is also with the Neverending Story the nebulous, but somehow more frightening because of that concept of the nothing, and it represents different things for different people. But what it's generally saying is that the nothing is when you lose your ability to interact with fantasy and magic and your wonder as a child. Obviously, as a child, you don't really see that. This is some nebulous shadow on the horizon. But I think everybody watching that feels the truth of it. The fact that there will come a time when you won't believe in fairy tales and when everything will seem very bleak because of it. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was a difficult one to sort of encapsulate as a child, but looking back, I think it's kind of that representative of there's an adult world and it may not be as bright as the place you're living right now, kind of thing, because even with all the danger and everything, it was still a better place than nothing at all.
So
that one is full of themes, as you say, very, very theme heavy. And very heavy for a child film.
I mean, I really loved it. I really did. But by God, that really got to me.
I think that one really sort of taps into the whole, why are children so fascinated with things that are so upsetting? Because generally they are. And, you know, as children we are. As in, we're kind of fascinated by the things that frighten us as well. Or we're drawn to them. In a lot of ways. And yeah, children do self-censor if they think something is really too much for them.
Yeah.
Usually. But you kept being pulled back to that film because it was so rich and full of this almost forbidden matter, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a brilliant adventure as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Visually spectacular, but the first one, that first movie terrified me so much. I was so scared.
Do you know, I think the first time I saw it, when Falcor the Luck Dragon shows up, to start with, I was a little bit freaked out by him.
He's actually kind of freaky.
And then you sort of think, oh, no, he's actually a really nice dragon, really, kind of thing. But okay, this next one, I think you'll probably agree with me on. I still love it, but seeing it as a child was incredibly traumatic. And I'm pretty sure I had nightmares. And that's Watership Down.
Oh, God.
The original one with John Hurt and Richard Briers, the good one, not the remake bollocks. Sorry, they've remade Watership Down both as a series and as another film, and both of them are kind of crap. But the original was, it pulls no punches.
It really doesn't.
It cuts some of the book out, understandably, because there are lots of other stories of El Herrera, for example, and there are other bits and things, and they sort of condense a lot, but they've got the main bulk of the book there, and it is really scary. I think the bit that gets me is when Holly is talking about how the Sandalford Warren was destroyed, and, you know, that... Everyone must know the premise of Watership Down. Basically, Fiver has a vision and persuades his brother Hazel to go to the Chief Rabbit. And the Chief Rabbit's kind of like, we're not moving during May. It's the mating season and you're being ridiculous. And so a small bunch of discontented rabbits from the Warren set off trying to find a place. And there's all sorts of strange and terrible things that happen to this group of journeyers on the way. Including Bigwig nearly dying in a snare. That's pretty dark as well. And a bunch of other stuff, including a dying Warren, where Silverweed is talking about death being an inevitability and the only thing you could do is lie down and surrender to it, sort of in a sort of very maudlin, I'm in love with death emo kind of way.
Yeah.
So all of that's pretty dark. And then they managed to find this place on Watership Down, which is suitable for them. And then one of the rabbits, Captain Holly, turns up from the Sandalford Warren, and he's in a terrible state. And he tells them what happened at home, and Fiver's vision had come true. And basically men have moved in with diggers and things, and they've completely destroyed the Warren, and they gassed all the rabbits. And it just gives you this montage of all these rabbits trapped underground, panicking. As you know, the air turns bad and they suffocate and they're desperately trying to get out, and the runs are crammed with bodies, and you're kind of like, okay, that's pulled no punches at all.
Seriously, hasn't.
That's pretty bad. That's strong stuff, as in you're glued to it, fascinated as a child by this terrible thing you're seeing happen, and you can't help but root for these rabbits. And then you hear the other part of Holly's story, which is that he came upon another Warren whilst he was looking for Hazel and Bigwig and Fiver, etc. And this Warren is basically a totalitarian regime, and Holly got co-opted into it whether he wanted to or not, and they sort of mark you to give you a scar so that you'll know which mark you belong to. And it's difficult to do justice to exactly what's going on there. Basically, this is talking about sort of some of the things that were going on at Russia at the time that the book was written, back in the early 70s. So, you know, it's quite scary stuff in that respect. But again, when Holly's talking about it, and then later when Bigwig is sent by Hazel to infiltrate this place, that's pretty damn scary as well. And then you've got Woundwort, the half-blind... massive boss rabbit, the chief from the other Warren. There's a big boss showdown as well. And as if that all that wasn't scary enough, every so often the black rabbit of Inley shows up as well. The black rabbit is the rabbit death, and he's not necessarily unkind or anything, but he's just sort of like, yes, but I am death, so when I show up and I call you, you have to go with me, kind of thing. Which, again, is still quite creepy for a child.
I think the most traumatic thing for me, though, in Watership Down, is this moment where they're going through, they come across this place which seems ideal, and they say, oh yeah, the humans leave food out for us and stuff like that, and it's basically a rabbit farm. And it's just this reality that's like, well, we know that eventually some of us will be killed, but the rest of us, they keep us healthy, they keep us happy, but we know that we're eventually going to be killed.
Yeah, and as long they sort of trick the new group in sort of not telling them about the shining wires, as Silverweed calls them, in the sense of, yeah, well, if the newcomers don't know about it, they're more likely to get killed than our Warren, and we might live a bit longer. And they won't move away because they're being fed, but at the same time, they're not safe there, and they know they're not safe there.
And they that was the thing, is that they decided not to tell the other group, because they're like, well, they can die instead. And then you see one of the characters, and I can't remember which one it is, actually get caught in one of these wire traps.
Yes, Bigwig.
And that is, the visuals on that scared the living daylights out of me. It was so terrifying, because you saw the blood appearing on his nose as he's gasping for air, and they're desperately trying to chew him out of it. And they were not pulling any punches. They're like, no, we're going to really show you this rabbit suffocating so that you understand how this works. Like, oh god.
The visuals actually really match the description of the book there as well, and you know, you sort of suffer along with the rabbits as they're sort of desperately trying to dig the peg out and chew through it, and it's just as you say, it is, that's a really sort of oh my god type moment, particularly as a child.
It was terrifying. Really, really scared me. And once again, it was dealing with the theme of death. I mean, the Bigwig doesn't actually die in that moment, so spoilers. They do actually manage to save him, which is kind of what made it okay. Because can you imagine if, like, that all happened and then he's dead? And you just had to watch that. That was just... oh god, even thinking about it is giving me chills. It really, really scared me.
See, this is where I admit that, you know, I have areas where I'm a bit of a wimp too. There is another film made by the same guys at roughly the same time, also from a Richard Adams book, called The Plague Dogs. I have not managed to get through that entire film yet. The Plague Dogs is about an animal experimentation lab, and it deals with things like vivisection, and there are two dogs who manage to escape, and people start to believe that they're carrying this terrible plague. They're not really, but they're sort of desperately trying to escape, and they've had awful things done to them. It doesn't end happily. I don't need to go into details, but just to say that that film's out there as well, and it's just sort of like, oh, I can't get to the end of the film yet.
It's just,
I think I'd be all right if it was people, but because it's dogs, I'm like, no, can't do it.
It is this weird thing where it's the same, like, going back to Neverending Story. I was also quite a horsey, like, I loved horses when I was little as well. So I think that also particularly hurt me. But you were right, that because they're animals, in some ways it's meant to be, oh, they're animals, so we're a little bit separated from them, so we can deal with it. Certainly, I don't think they would have shown a human being garrotted slowly. That would have been way too much. But
it's fine, because it's a,
like,
rabbit.
It's, and you're not, like, fine.
It's not fine. It's actually worse. I honestly don't think they'd get away with making it in that way today. Not where you can see the blood and foam on his lips and his eyes rolling back and what have you.
I don't think they'd be able to do that, because that was... oh, anyway.
Have you got one that you want to go next with?
Yes. Okay, so I've mentioned this before, and probably this is quite personal, but Labyrinth... as a child,
I wouldn't say it didn't traumatize me, but we talked about how it captured my imagination, so we won't go into that again for me. But
again, I'm just talking about stuff that really got under my skin and really freaked me out. And there were lots of things in Labyrinth which really did scare me. But there are two scenes in particular which actually kind of really worried me as a child. So the first one is the one with, and again, I'm almost certain that it's from this that I get my dislike of puppets. Is from Labyrinth. It's from Labyrinth, and it was the one with all of the firebirds or whatever they are.
The fireys, the fire dance.
And their whole sequence with the removal of heads and stuff like that. I really didn't like it. I really didn't like it. It was just too uncanny for me. It really upset me and it scared me. And I think the thing that scared me the most was this fact that all of them, to them it was perfectly fine, it was normal, they were just playing. And then they really want to take off, is it Sarah? Is that what she's called? Yeah. They want to take off Sarah's head. And they become quite vicious about it. They're like, no, you've got to do what we're doing. And that really scared me. It really did. And it's touching into this idea that of universal experiences and assuming that everyone has a universal experience as well. And it was something incredibly, but whilst also being incredibly unhuman. And yet you look at it and you're like, okay, but it's unhuman to them, but we do similar things to one another and to other things. And it was just very disturbing for me. And it took me a long time to figure out why, because I was like, it's not like it exactly looks real. It's not like, you know, they're humans who are pulling off their heads. In fact, I kind of would have been probably relatively okay if it was humans pulling off their heads. But for some reason, the way that it was just put together, it was very malicious and it was menacing, and the thing that was the scariest about it was that they were just having fun. They were enjoying it. They had no care what was happening beyond their circle. They were just enjoying themselves. And they wanted to do it to Sarah. And it wasn't out of a desire to hurt her. It was out of a complete disregard for the fact that it would hurt her.
Yeah, so fairies.
Exactly. Yes. Very much so. And yet, God, it just scared me. It really scared me. So that was one. Then the other scene that really frightened me is the one where she kind of ends up on this huge rubbish heap.
Yeah, that's with the pack women who are sorting through the rubbish, and I think what strikes me about that was the way that it's very dark and grim from when you're looking at it close up, but then you realize that literally this is just the midden outside the castle. But the problem with it is that this is the place where you're very close to your destination, but you can still lose your way because your memories have been messed with. That's very eerie, that idea that you can't trust your memories.
But the thing for me that really scared me was that she climbs into bed and goes, oh, it was all a dream. And she has this great sense of relief. And then this pack woman comes in and goes, oh, look at this. And I was like, oh, God. That's terrifying.
I kind of liked that they reversed the whole, oh, it was just a dream thing.
It's true. But
it made it terrifying.
It's really scary. But again, I think the reason that really scared me was that later in life, I've had kind of experiences like that where bad things have happened. Like when my grandfather died, my mother had already been terminal for a while, and so what happened was that I would dream a lot that she was dead, and then I would wake up and I would remember, no, she's not dead, she is dying. And it also meant that I ruminated a lot on the idea of what is life going to be like when she's gone and stuff. And then I would sort of, it would get very, very dark for me. And then I'd be like, but she's not. And I could snap out of it and go, whew. And there was this element of relief. So when my grandfather died, I was in total shock because it happened incredibly suddenly. And we weren't expecting it in the least. And my dad was like, right, okay, so we've booked flights for you tomorrow morning early to come out so that we can get there for the funeral. And I had been working and I was totally exhausted. And I'd just been packing and everything was in a haze. And I just remember I was just stood there in the bathroom brushing my teeth. And I suddenly went, oh my God, I'm just dreaming. It's fine. It's fine. None of this is real. And then I went, oh God, no, it is real. And then a few minutes later, I went, oh, thank God, no, none of it is real. And it wasn't just a side thought. It was a complete, I 100% for a few seconds genuinely believed, oh no, it's fine. Everything's fine. And I had experiences like that throughout my life. And so there was something about Labyrinth as well, but that idea really scared me, that you could have a genuine moment of relief and then the nightmare, but the nightmare hasn't ended. You are living the nightmare. And you can kind of be tricked like that. It's really scary.
Yeah, it's the Pet Sematary thing, isn't it?
It's this idea that you cannot trust your senses and that you might not actually know when you're awake or asleep as well.
Yeah.
And as a child, you kind of, you need those boundaries to be able to trust what you see, to be able to trust what you feel. And you know, children have a lot of nightmares and stuff like that. So they want to be able to wake up and then be assured, no, it was just a dream.
Yeah, agreed. And sort of cycling back to The Last Unicorn, I think that is part of what hit me with that, was the way that, you know, she's clearly not a very well-adjusted young woman when she gets turned into a woman. She even says, but I'm always dreaming, even when I'm awake. The borders of her reality have been completely shattered and she doesn't know what or who she is. And that was terrifying.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's sort of this same thing, this idea that the world is not how it's supposed to be, that there isn't an order like you think there is, particularly when you're a child.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think that was especially scary as a child.
Okay, I'm going to move on to some actual Don Bluth films now. You can tell me whether you've seen them or not. I'm sure you've seen... I won't go into too much detail on this one, but there is a moment that's worth mentioning, I feel, and I haven't seen this film for a really long time, so it might not be as scary as it was in my memory. And that's An American Tale. Mm. Which basically follows the story of a family immigrating from Poland to America, except they're mice. And it's sad in the sense of Fievel gets separated from his family. He just gets kind of lost. So that's bad, and he falls in with some interesting company, sort of Artful Dodger style, etc. And, you know, it's kind of a cool little story. And then you get to the end and there's this sort of giant fire-breathing mouse-cat hybrid monstrosity machine. Which is genuinely kind of like, where the fuck did that come from? It's kind of, oh, it's Don Bluth. You can't have a film without something really scarring happening in it. Because the whole idea of being separated from your family on a new continent and never knowing how you're going to find them amongst the millions of other people there, that wasn't traumatic enough. No, we have to have a monster as well. So, yes, there's that one. I must watch that film again sometime. It's been a long time. The one that really sort of sticks with me is The Secret of Nim.
Yeah.
Have you seen that
one? No, I haven't.
See, I'm recommending all of these for your viewing pleasure, but if you watch them, I think you'll see what I mean about watching them as a child. The Secret of Nim deals with a mouse called Mrs. Frisbee. It's mice again. And she has four children, and one of them, Timothy, is very, very sick. Every year, what they do, when the field is ploughed, they move to their summer accommodation on the edge of the woods. But Timothy has pneumonia, so they can't move out of the brick, the hollow brick they normally live in. and when the field is ploughed, the brick will be flooded with mud and everybody inside will die.
Right.
So what she does is, because this, it turns out there's something a little bit strange about Mrs. Frisbee's family. And you find out later on through the film that Mr. Frisbee, who unfortunately died, was actually part of a group of experimental mice along with the rats. And he's still held in very high regard by the rats because Mr. Frisbee helped the rats escape from Nim. Nim is the place where they were experimented on. These rats and mice were given super intelligence and they escaped because suddenly they could read how to open their cages.
Right.
Except the rats were too big to be able to do what they needed to do, but Mr. Frisbee wasn't. So he and Mr. Ages, another mouse, managed to break them all out of Nim. So, yeah, the fact that part of it is set in an animal experimentation lab, again, yes, kind of traumatic. Then there's the owl. Mrs. Frisbee has been told that if she is ever in real trouble, she should go and see the owl. Now, the idea of a mouse going to visit an owl in its hollow tree, bad idea for a start, because, you know, that's like a pizza walking into your house and asking for advice.
Yes.
You know, this is not going to go well for one of you, and it's probably not going to be the owl. The owl does help her, but Don Bluth seems to have a real thing about making owls absolutely terrifying. You know, weird glowy eyes without pupils and sort of cobwebs hanging off them and huge sharp beaks and things. It's really focusing on it from a mouse's point of view with all of these things. Happens again in Thumbelina.
Yes.
So Don Bluth, freaky owls. And then there's the whole thing whereby she does finally go and see the rats. The rats are actually kind of scary, even though they're kindly intended towards her. And they say, well, what we'll do is we'll set up a pulley system and we'll move the brick for you. And it all gets very, very close to the line when they're trying to move this brick for her. And the field's actually being ploughed as it happens. And something goes horribly wrong with the pulley, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, I'll stop there, but it ends well. But it's quite a very tense film. And even with everything working out right and the fact that Mrs. Frisbee in the end turns out to be the one, because of the strength of her conviction and her love for her family and everything, who literally has the strength to do what's needed to be done. There's something a little bit eerie about the way that she does it, in the sense of you don't feel entirely comfortable that it worked out that way. This is not a case of you look and you say, oh, a superpower, excellent, magic, wonderful. You're kind of looking at it thinking, that's actually almost frightening that she can do it.
Yeah. Okay. I've not watched it and I'm not sure whether I want to now.
Okay. Yes. I've got a few more Don Bluth films, but do you have one you'd like to discuss before I go on to those?
Okay, so this is technically not a children's thing, but it's something that children are often taken to see, particularly in theatre. And everyone, all the people I know who ever studied drama at school, were taken to see The Woman in Black, the play, when they were about 13 years old. So many people. So I'm going to include this because apparently it's a thing where they suddenly go, 13-year-olds, this is a good age to go and take them to see this play. And let me tell you right now, it's not a good age to see that play. It really isn't. Why? And I think, okay, so the reason why The Woman in Black is so terrifying, and again, I'm talking about all of these ideas, and I'm not saying that they're bad things at all. I love a lot of the concepts now. I'm saying that being introduced to these concepts as a child might have been potentially a little bit much. We might not have been quite ready for them. The Woman in Black absolutely terrified me. I had nightmares for weeks, it completely changed my whole attitude to pretty much everything supernatural. And in fact, I say I had nightmares for weeks. I was affected for it for years after I saw it. Bearing in mind, I was at school in a very, very old building, which was incredibly creaky at night. And mega haunted. We just didn't know it yet. And that I was also a massive insomniac, which meant that while everyone else was asleep, I was lying awake in this ancient building, listening to what sounded like something walking up and down the corridor outside.
Yeah.
So it really scared me. But the thing about the woman in black, which is the most terrifying, is the complete powerlessness that you have. And also, it's not just malicious. It is just this force of nature which literally doesn't even see you. It has no regard for you. And that is the most terrifying thing. Because up until this point, we'd seen, you know, oh, people die in a tragic accident. Okay, fine. So, all right, there was a storm. There was nothing that could be done. The ship went down, you know. Or, oh, you know, there was a murderer and they killed them for, you know, for greed or whatever. All of these things have a reason. With the woman in black, the general plot is that there is this ghost who anyone who sees her, whenever anyone sees her, a child will die. It's as simple as that. And she's doing it simply because her child died and she's angry about it. And that's it. She just induces children to die everywhere. And you have no choice. It's not, if you come near me, I'll do it, or if you come into my house. It's just, if you happen to see her and she just wanders around. It's sheer complete luck. That's it. You know, and sorry, luck is not the right word. it's complete chance of whether you see her. And the thing is that there's nothing you can do about it. And there's no reason for it either. It's entirely random. And you are entirely powerless to stop it. You know, Kipps leaves. He runs away. He goes all the way back to London at the end. And it doesn't stop anything. The woman is still there. And she gets her revenge, except she's not getting her revenge on him. She doesn't really care about him. She doesn't really care about his children. It's not personal in any way. It's just a part of this force of nature, which is not acting because it's just the natural order of things, but is acting in an unnatural manner simply because she can. And that is, it's really, really scary, actually.
I can see how, as a child, that would be particularly affecting, because once again, it's that need for the universe to have set parameters.
Yes, exactly.
And for there to be reasons for things happening, yeah, and what have you. So, not an animated children's film, admittedly.
Yeah. No. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I'll admit that. But I did kind of want to mention it simply because it was just one that had a really powerful effect.
No, fair enough. Okay. Back to Don Bluth. And I don't know whether... Say if you've seen these or not, but I'm not going to go into too much detail. Again, a lot of these I haven't seen for years now, but they sort of bits of sort of have struck me. Not really so much scary, but disturbing in the sense of what was happening in the film. Fern Gully and the idea that the destructive force that was tearing down the rainforest gained a consciousness, and that bit of it was actually quite disturbing in the sense of, because there was a lot of awareness being raised about the rainforest at the time that I actually saw the film, and it was this awful thing that was happening that you actually had no control over. There was nothing you could do about it as a child. So there's that. And it's this sort of demonic entity that overtakes basically this huge digger type thing. It's threatening the Fern Gully and the sort of Amazon rainforest fairies.
Yeah.
which makes the film sound twee, but it's actually really not twee at all. It's quite an intelligent film. Again, very, very bittersweet ending. All Dogs Go to Heaven, which I loved, but in All Dogs Go to Heaven, this is really raising the question about who deserves to go where, and they're using dogs as the vehicle. And the thing is, Charlie, the dog who gets murdered very early on in the film by another dog, Carface, and his gang, he turns up in heaven and the guardian is sort of like, oh, don't worry, dogs naturally go to heaven because dogs are naturally good and loyal and kind. And then she's looking through the book of his life saying, I'm having a little difficulty finding goodness, loyalty or kindness here. And she's trying to sell him on the virtues of heaven, etc. And Charlie's sort of halfway through going, hang on a minute, you mean I'm dead? I don't want to be dead. I want to go back there and get the person who did this to me. And he manages to escape from heaven. And she sort of says to him, you know, if you go, you can never come back here. But he's sort of quite short-sightedly going, it doesn't matter, I'm going back to live, I want to be alive. And I think we can all kind of understand that, but looking forward, he's kind of really gambled what happens afterwards, which would be considerably a much longer period of time. It all gets tangled up with the life of this orphan girl who can talk to animals. And she's a gold mine for these dogs, which are running sort of like this syndicate, because she can talk to the horses and find out which one of the horses is going to win in their races, so they can place bets and make loads of money, etc. And mice. So she's got this gift, and all these different factions of the animal gang world want her for this. So again, this is really quite mature themes and things about morality for children here. And then Charlie starts to realise exactly what he gambled away by leaving heaven and then sort of really falling for this girl, and in the sense of, you know, in the way that a dog kind of does fall for its owner, sort of realising that, yeah, actually, I do feel loyalty for her, I feel responsible for her, I want to protect her. And he dreams about hell. He literally dreams about Carface thrusting him into hell. And it's really, really graphic.
Yeah.
So while I don't really appreciate the whole sort of heaven and hell thing being held up so as, you know, such a binary in a children's film, the idea of questioning your choices and finding something worthwhile to pursue is a very apposite one for children, but it's still pretty damn scary. There's that one. But the one I think that got me the most is The Land Before Time.
Oh God, The Land Before Time.
And it's okay, so you've got Littlefoot is a brontosaurus, and his mother gets killed by a sharp tooth or a Tyrannosaurus Rex. You've got the traumatic parent death for the get-go, and then he sort of gathers this found family of little hatchling dinosaurs around him, and they're off to find the Great Valley. Because the Earth is dying. And then it's only as an adult that I realised that the reason the Earth is dying is because this is post-meteorite. All the dinosaurs are going to die whether they find the Great Valley or not. And it's kind of like, oh my God, you absolute bastard! It's like, it was traumatic enough when you see at the end they have actually reached the Great Valley, and you think, oh yeah, they're going to survive. And then you realise that actually it's post-meteorite. That's why they're all dying. That's why there are all these dinosaur skeletons scattered around, because the meteorite's happened and the Earth is cooling down. And oh God, it's just awful.
Oh my God. I did not realise that.
Thank you, Don Bluth. No, you've haunted my childhood nightmares, so thank you for that. God.
I think, I don't remember if it's the same film or maybe a sequel or something like that, but there's also one where there's this plague of locusts.
I'm not sure I remember that.
Yeah, so I
that.
Think it's actually, there's a second film.
Oh, they did make another two or three, but I think the first one was sort of, I might have seen the second one, but I think I kind of lost interest after that.
But the second one is also really bloody terrifying, because there's this plague of locusts that comes and eats all of their food in just this massive cloud. So it's not traumatic, but it was the first time I came across the concept of locusts. And I tell you what, they are scary. But it's also the fact that, yeah, they're then going hungry. They have to find food. This promised place where they were all thriving is now completely barren because these locusts have just completely eaten all of their food, everything, in the space of a few, you know, in the space of a few hours. That's it. They've lost everything.
So they're
not having a good time of it, are they, Jules?
No, they're really not. I think there may have been even four films thinking about it, but I think the second one came out quite a bit after the first one, and I'd got a bit older, so I wasn't quite as bothered by then. Yes, one that did affect me as a child, and this is one that my dad thought was suitable to hire out for his 8-year-old daughter. He wasn't wrong, I was fascinated, but that's Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, which is a Studio Ghibli film. I love Studio Ghibli, but the more environmentally conscious ones are incredibly scarring.
Yeah.
So you've got things like Princess Mononoke, which is really intense,
is probably the best word. I mean, there's a whole bit of, like, zombies at one point. It's a really scary film.
What happens when you mistreat the spirit of the wood, the spirit of nature? Nausicaa is a post-apocalyptic set story. There's been this huge war between humans and the giant creatures they created to fight for them. So you come in at the beginning and you just see the remains sort of scattered around and burnt out cities. And in the Valley of the Wind, they've kind of managed to make a life for themselves. So they're using renewable energy sources, etc. And they've learned to live next to what is effectively poison jungle. Yeah. All these things that have basically grown up out of what would appear to have been a nuclear holocaust. So you're already starting from a position of being really, really uncomfortable. There are these giant bug things as well, various different species. But there's the Om. The Om are these massive, massive, multifaceted, multi-eyed sort of beetle slug-type creatures that are humongous, absolutely huge. And when they're angry, they'll destroy everything in their path. And the whole thing is again, it's about, there's no real bad guys as such. There's people who are acting in a greedy manner that doesn't really benefit everybody else. And by doing so, they are driving the Om mad, and the Om are going mad and sort of destroying everything. Yeah. And again, a bit like Watership Down, it really doesn't pull punches. You know, you see her, you see the main character Nausicaa actually get shot through the heel and shot through the arm and things, and blood flies everywhere. And it's just sort of like, I don't think this was really supposed to be a children's film. I think this was an animated feature film for adults, which was made in the era whereby if you made anything animated, it was by default for children.
Yes, I think that was also a massive error, which was that people were making things in Japan and they went, it's animated, therefore it's for children. It was this complete misunderstanding in the Western world of taking things from other cultures and not realizing that actually they might not be up to the same, you know, it might not be the same rules.
I think I saw a bunch of things like that, and they weren't all Studio Ghibli either. There was the one that I can't remember the name of it, but it was really traumatic, as in this family is on a spaceship and they go down to a planet, and then there's a storm and the little boy gets separated from the family, but they have to leave. And then when they're in space, they're sort of looking for him again, and they spend decades looking for this boy. They spend a really long time looking for him. They finally get back to the planet and there's an old man there, and they think they can ask him, have you seen our son, kind of thing. And it's only later on that you realise that the planet was moving on a different speed time-wise, and this is actually their little boy. And he's grown up and grown old alone on this planet by himself. And it's just like, oh my god, why would you tell me this?
That's terrifying.
Certainly as a child. As an adult, that's kind of like, oh, that's unsettling. But that's unsettling in a way that's more comfortable for adults, but for, as a child, it's kind of like, you can get lost and no one will find you, no one will come to rescue you. That's terrifying. Yeah.
That is, that's really, really scary. Okay. I think we've actually run out of time.
We have. There's one scene I want to mention. This is the Disney scene I was talking about. And it was something I hadn't really seen Disney ever do before or since, really. I wasn't really a child. I was about 14, I think, when the film came out. And that's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And it's the song Hellfire.
Oh, yes.
And it's Hellfire and Heaven's Light, but Hellfire is the bit where Judge Frollo is actually singing about his desire for Esmeralda and the fact that he doesn't feel good with this. He feels that he's being bewitched and that the feelings she's inspired are her fault. And it's a brilliant piece of misogyny set to a catchy tune. And it's I don't know, I've never seen Disney deal with sort of sexual desire and the repression of sexual desire like that before or since, and it's incredibly disturbing.
It really is, actually, and it's just this idea that, of if she can't be mine, then let me destroy her as well.
Yeah.
Which is really frightening. And yet, I think, was a really important message to give, because it's actually something which happens, really.
Yeah, definitely.
So you are absolutely right. I mean, The Hunchback of Notre Dame is actually also kind of a scary film in general, and I honestly think that if they didn't have the gargoyles, it would have been it would have had a very different tone.
It's very rare that I go, I actually prefer the Disney version of this when I've read the book, but I'm like, I actually prefer the Disney version of this because that book is so depressing.
What do you expect from, what's his name? Victor Hugo.
Well, I mean, I actually like Victor Hugo. I think he's an awesome writer, but oh my God, The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah, Victor Hugo is an awesome writer. The funniest thing I ever discovered about Victor Hugo was his sex habits. He was a massive slut. He had...
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
He had sex an extraordinary amount. And, like, a huge amount. Like, I've heard that his chroniclers literally gave up because he was just be having sex with different people, like, four times a day or something stupid like that. Like, he was having a lot of sex. And apparently, again, I've heard, I can't confirm, but apparently on the day of his funeral, all the brothels in Paris closed down for the day in remembrance of Victor Hugo.
Oh, best customer. Oh my God.
Again, this is what I've heard, so I can't confirm whether it is true or not, but certainly Victor Hugo was... enjoyed having sex a great deal, which is just what makes everything really funny when you just remember, it's like, oh, Victor Hugo, that, you know, classic writer. I'm like, yeah, the guy is just having a lot of sex constantly.
Mind you, I'm not stereotyping here, but based on the literature and everything that I've read, the French were far less repressed about that at the time that these 19th century novels were being created, whereas over here in the UK, it's kind of like, you did not let anybody know you were getting up to shit like that.
No. The French very much have a different attitude toward all of that, really. Personally, I think it's the religious thing, the different churches that might play into that.
Yeah, anyway, definitely.
Subject for another day. Indeed. But that's our fun fact for the day. Victor Hugo was a massive slut. And good for him. Good for him. I hope you felt empowered. And, you know, as long as everything was above board, great. So there we go. Fun fact of the day. Before we go, though, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And I've actually got one for you this week, guys, and it's an oldie rather than a new one. I would like to recommend the Justice League animated series. So that's Justice League and then Justice League Unlimited. I've been watching them recently, and they're brilliant. They're really, really, really good. You have to watch the first two Justice League series to begin with, which are very good anyway, and then you get to Unlimited, which is just brilliant and has some of the best and most surprisingly funny writing that you would expect, and some very serious kind of episodes as well. So I really, really do have to recommend it. It's certainly one of the, for me, one of the best introductions into kind of the larger DC universe as well. So if you want to kind of be introduced to various different characters and things like that, it's a really, really good way of doing it and kind of getting an overview of the world. Very, very good series. Highly recommended.
Cool.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment telling us which films traumatized you as a child.
Yeah, share your childhood scars with us, film-wise.
And until next week, we'll say thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.